The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, few people may have seen St. Elmo's fire, the mythical glow that appears on structures and ships at sea during thunderstorms. But a team of researchers has discovered the fabled phenomenon is quite common. You just need the right equipment to see it. And we'll discuss two recent landmark court decisions against social media companies. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. You might have heard of St. Elmo's Fire, and no, I'm not talking about the movie from the 1980s. St. Elmo's Fire is an atmospheric phenomenon that few have seen. It sometimes appears as a faint glow on tall trees or church steeples during thunderstorms, and was regarded by sailors as a good omen when it illuminated the masts of their ships. But you don't need to be on a ship out in the middle of the ocean to see it. You might just need the right tools. Our guest is Patrick McFarland, a PhD graduate student of meteorology and atmospheric science at Penn State University. After recording the purple glow on spruce needles in the lab when placing a branch between charged metal plates, Patrick and his team drove around in a minivan modified with scientific equipment to detect coronae on trees during storms. I spoke with him to learn more.
We really got into this from the idea of atmospheric chemistry. A little bit of background is that we put out a paper in 2021 that linked lightning to the production of this chemical called hydroxyl that helps to clean the air. And so I think we got really, really interested in figuring out, okay, if lightning can be a potentially significant source of cleansing, are there maybe a whole bunch of weaker discharges like these corona that could also be a potentially important source of cleansing for the atmosphere?
And so when you mean cleansing, what exactly are you referring to?
Yeah, so hydroxyl, you can kind of think of hydroxyl, which is basically just a water vapor molecule that's lost one of its hydrogen atoms. So now instead of H2O, it's just one O and one H. And hydroxyl is very, very reactive. So it'll react with and remove a lot of pollutants that are emitted from trees. It'll also react with a couple of greenhouse gases like carbon monoxide and methane and help to remove them from the atmosphere. So we like to think of hydroxyl as like the atmospheric Pac-Man, and that it just helps to eat up a whole bunch of pollutants and help to remove them from the atmosphere.
So what was your idea then, your hypothesis between the connection between hydroxyl and St. Elmo's fire, this mythical glow that occurs on trees and ships out at sea during thunderstorms?
Yeah, so I think, so we did a couple of lab tests, and those lab tests were really part of the PhD work from my colleague, Gina Jenkins, who's also a co-author on this paper. And her lab studies showed that, you know, if you measure these corona in the ultraviolet, then you can estimate the amount of hydroxyl that's being made. And so that was really a big clue into determining, okay, how can we actually go about trying to measure these corona, because they're so weak. You know, very, very few people have ever seen them before. Like sailors on seeing these corona on their ship masts are one of the only real observations that we have of these corona. And so once we sort of figured out how in the laboratory we could go about trying to measure both corona as well as the hydroxyl that they produced, that's sort of what clued us into trying to build this instrument that we then fit into a van and go storm chasing and just measure this glow.
And tell me about this instrument that was strapped on top of this minivan, if you will, because the photo that I saw was pretty funny, because you have this minivan, and in the photo, the door is slid open, and then there's this piece of, I can only describe it as vaguely scientific-looking equipment strapped on top of this van. But you tell me what it's all about.
Sure, yeah. So on top of the van, we have a periscope, and all that periscope has in it is two flat mirrors that allow us to basically spin that periscope in any direction. So we can spin it 360 degrees and it'll look wherever we point it. And then those two mirrors that are inside of this periscope send light and send ultraviolet radiation down into the van. So it goes through the roof, and then inside of the van, we took out one of the seats, and where that seat used to be, we put a telescope. And what that telescope does is it takes the light coming down from the periscope, and the telescope focuses that light onto our ultraviolet detector, which is sort of off to the side and behind where the telescope is. It's sort of closer to the trunk in that picture that I think you're referring to.
And so then this corona that you're trying to detect, this is not something that when you are detecting it, you can see it with the naked eye?
Yeah, no, it's really, really tough to try to see these corona with the human eye, just because there's so much competition in the visible wavelength region where we see. So any light from the sun or from flashlights or even the light from your cell phone is bright enough to really make these corona glows invisible to our eyes. So that's another reason why we decided to go and look in the ultraviolet, because in the ultraviolet, there's a whole lot less competition. So anything that we see in the ultraviolet, we can have a really, really high degree of confidence that those signals have to be from these corona discharges that we're seeing.
So when it comes to using this minivan-mounted periscope, what was that process like when you're out chasing storms with this equipment in this van? Tell me a little bit about the chase there.
Yeah, so a typical day was we would wake up super early in the morning, try to kind of figure out generally where the greatest forecast of thunderstorms was, and then we would just drive to that area. If that was, a 5 or 6 hour drive, so be it. That was our morning. We'd spend the morning driving to that area. We try to find like a public place to hang out, watch storms develop on the radar, keep looking at updated models and updated forecasts. And then once a storm popped up that we felt like we were in good enough position to maybe go and get in front of it or intercept that storm, we'd have to drive to a few minutes ahead of the storm, and we'd have to try to find a public place, so like a public park or a large open parking lot where we weren't disturbing anything or bothering anybody. And then we'd have to find a tree. And ideally, we would find a relatively tall tree so that we could spin up our periscope and point it up at the top of that tall tree. And then once we have our instrument all set up, we're in position, the storm comes overhead, and we just kind of let the storm roll overhead. We sit underneath the storm, and we just point our periscope up and measure the glow and measure any signals we see for as long as the storm's rolling over us.
What lets you know that there is, in fact, St. Elmo's fire actually occurring if it's something that you can't see with the human eye under normal circumstances?
Yeah, good question. So we have our ultraviolet camera is a black and white camera. So anywhere where there's black, which is most of the place, most of the time, that means that there's no ultraviolet signals, anywhere within our camera's field of view. But then you'll see these white dots that pop up and kind of hop from place to place. And those white dots are the ultraviolet signals, so the emissions from the St. Elmo's fire, the corona, that our camera is actually detecting. And what's really obvious when we're just sitting under a storm, sort of staring at this computer screen showing the output of our video, is you'll see these white dots move and sway in the wind as the branches sort of move and sway in the wind as well.
So does it look like the outline of a tree then made of these white dots when you're looking through this equipment?
So it doesn't really look like the outline of the tree. No, our field of view, so we can only see a very, very tiny portion of the tree. Usually we look at like a single branch at the very, very top of the tree. And these corona are very sporadic and they sort of jump from place to place. So we'll see like one of these white dots on maybe one side of the branch, and then a fraction of a second later, that white dot will hop over to the other side of the branch, and then maybe it'll hop up to the top of the branch. So it's almost like a whole bunch of individual fireflies that sort of flicker on and off. Maybe that's a better way to think about it.
So what is going on during a thunderstorm in order to actually detect this phenomenon? What's going on in the atmosphere?
So what the thunderstorm does is it supplies some charge, right? That's how you get lightning, ultimately, is you have this buildup of charge within the thunderstorm, and then this charge becomes so concentrated to the point that the air can't insulate anymore, and you get breakdown and you get lightning. So there's this charge that's sitting in the thunderstorm, and this charge in the thunderstorm causes a charge of the opposite sign. So if the thunderstorm is mostly negatively charged, let's say, then you'll get a positive charge in the ground. And that, because opposite charges attract, that positive ground charge is going to try to get as close as it can to the negative charge in the thunderstorm. So that positive ground charge is going to travel up to the tallest point it can reach. And in a forest, that tallest point is going to be the tops of trees. And then once you get this charge that travels up to the tops of trees, it gets concentrated around the leaf tips. And around these tips, the electric field that you need to get breakdown and to get these corona to form is reduced just because of the shape of the leaf. And so there's some interesting thought experiments that we've been doing about, okay, how does like leaf shape play an important role in corona formation? And so that's, I think, a really interesting avenue that we need to explore more into the future. But that's basically how you get these corona.
So why do you think that this research is important, and what's coming next for you? Is this something that you're going to continue to look into?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think this research is really important for a couple of reasons. First, I think it's another sort of piece in the puzzle of understanding how the natural world around us works, which I think is always a good thing to just understand and discover how the world around you works and functions. But then also, more specifically, these corona, I think, have a couple of pretty important impacts. In addition to the hydroxyl that they make, which could have pretty important impacts both on the local air composition and chemistry, but also just on potentially impacting the tree leaf itself. The fact that these charge concentrations build up around these leaves could have some implications or impacts on the trees themselves. So like in our lab tests, we saw that the tips of leaves that formed corona got burnt, like they were brown, discolored, and that burning could potentially damage the tree by potentially being a source of water loss. So maybe that burnt tip basically acts like a leaky faucet, and so leaves and trees get dehydrated. There's also some evidence that leaves that form these corona have a decreased concentration of chloroplasts, and chloroplasts are the part of the leaf that's actually responsible for photosynthesis, which converts carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, into food for the tree, but also oxygen. And then as far as future work, I think we're really, really interested in exploring and understanding exactly what those impacts on the tree are, as well as what the impacts of the hydroxyl that gets produced is on the local air chemistry and on the tree itself. And we've had a couple of conversations with some forest ecologists and plant biologists, and from our conversations, it seems like they didn't really know that these corona form on trees under thunderstorms. And so I think it's just a possibility to basically open up a whole new area, an avenue of research that's largely unexplored to this point.
Well, thank you so much for sharing and telling me about it. I appreciate it, Patrick.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for reaching out and for your interest.
Patrick McFarland is a PhD student at Penn State University. His research is published in Geophysical Research Letters. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. A pair of recent landmark court decisions are at the center of the national conversation surrounding social media companies, the addictive nature of their products, and their impacts on children's mental health. Recently, a New Mexico jury found Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, knew about the harmful effects of their products on children. In California, a federal jury awarded millions of dollars in damages to a woman who claimed using platforms Instagram and YouTube, which is owned by Google, as a child, led to her mental health problems. A day after the decision in California, I spoke with Sarah Domoff, a professor of psychology at the University at Albany and a leading researcher on children's and adolescent social media use, about the significance of the decisions.
In my work with children and teens and families, there's so much overwhelm and stress regarding how to navigate the digital age, specifically managing social media platforms and experiences that youth have on social media. So it's very overwhelming for a lot of families to navigate this. And in addition to the work that we do to build interventions to help teens navigate social media safely, we recognize that it can't just fall on the teens or the parents themselves, that tech companies also have a responsibility. And so these cases reiterate that premise, that we think that there are multiple avenues of intervention that must occur to keep children safe online.
And the gist of it is that the people who were harmed were exposed to social media at a young age and also use these platforms compulsively.
Yeah, so the piece that sticks out regarding the case that happened yesterday in Los Angeles is about the design features, so that there are features of the apps themselves that make it really hard to turn them off or, turn away from them. And as you can imagine, for adolescents, for developing minds, that's extra reinforcing. And so there's design features that include, those notifications that you receive, as well as unending feeds. But also when we look at the links between social media and mental health, it's the content. And so when we look at the algorithms and the content that's pushed to teens and to adults, frankly, if it's harmful, those with mental health vulnerabilities could be at greater risk. And that's kind of what the lawsuit was showing.
What are some of the negative impacts mm-hmm. that you might have seen mm-hmm. In your professional life from social media addiction?
So there are multiple ways that social media can create risks for youth. And it really falls down to this content piece and what we also call the context of use. So content meaning seeing content that may be triggering or exacerbating underlying mental health concerns is one piece. So there's been some really interesting research that's shown that individuals who have like histories of disordered eating or have eating disorders are more likely to be shown content that promotes that. And so it may actually be more harmful for some individuals because of these pre-existing concerns, specifically content that may exacerbate underlying mental health concerns. But then also we know that it's not just the content that one sees, it's also how hard it is to put it away, you know? And so that's where that compulsive or problematic, what some folks call addictive-like use, includes, where even though we want to cut back, we can't, and it's interfering with functioning. And for teens, especially, we see that link around nighttime. Nighttime use interfering with sleep, really getting in the way of their sleep health and then subsequent days functioning.
Do you agree with the assessment that social media has taken away people's ability to become bored or deal with boredom, accept and deal with boredom?
That's a really great question. I think that some of the short form videos and the features of the, whether it's social media or other like streaming services, make it so that there's seemingly endless content to consume. With that being said, when we look at the implications for regulation or changes that we can make to our own social media use, a lot of times we also want to bring up the fact that there's also changes happening in community level that make it really hard to do activities that aren't screen-based. So specifically, what can we do in like communities or in schools so that there are other opportunities or activities for children to engage in? So I don't know if it's boredom per se. Rather, there may not be as much available to teens or children to do outside of school to keep them engaged. And so we're really missing an element there that I think has also been included in some policy recommendations, that it's not just regulating tech, but also can we create environments or opportunities and communities where children and teens can be engaging with each other such that it's not so contingent on screen time to keep them occupied. So I think it's a complicated question.
New York has this year a statewide ban on smartphones in schools. How do you feel about that? Have you heard from any educators about how that's going now in, you know, in the springtime?
Anecdotally, I have heard from educators and folks who work in the schools that they're seeing some benefits. And I think it's really important, though, that we evaluate how does this have an impact on education, socializing, as well as potential mental health benefits. It's not 100% clear yet what the impacts are. So that's something that I'm really looking forward to investigating and learning more about. Importantly, while there could be no use during the school day, there are still risks that happen when teens use social media outside of school. And when we think about what's been mentioned about, you know, the lawsuit and so forth, we still want to help them learn how to regulate their use and help them cope with experiences that may happen online that can be really hard for them. So online victimization, cyberbullying, those still can happen even when we have bans or some restrictions in place. So in addition to regulation around content and these design features, we also have to really equip teens to be to use social media in healthy ways and feel resilient when they experience things on social media.
Do you think that is something that could come about as part of a school curriculum of a social media awareness?
Definitely. So some of the work that I've done in my research and in partnership with schools has been testing some of these curricula where we see, can we improve digital literacy and can we improve understandings about how we use social media so that we can get more of the benefits and less of the risks. And so part of that is increasing our awareness of how do we feel when we're using social media. This can really go for anyone of any age. Is there content that we're seeing that's bringing us down more than lifting us up? How are we engaging with the content that we're seeing? And part of all of this is like helping teens and other users feel equipped to, you know, get social media to work better for them versus the other way around. And part of what is exciting about coverage of this lawsuit is it opens a door more for conversations. And I think teens and parents can talk more about, well, what's going on behind the scenes in designing these apps? Why is it so hard for us to, you know, put them away or not be pulled into it? And I think it affords opportunities for that conversation to kind of question, you know, why we're not paying for this, right? But we are paying for this in our attention, in our energy, and the impacts that it has. So I think conversations regarding the outcome of this and how we want to engage with technology in different ways is going to be really important.
And not that you have a crystal ball, but do you think that because of these high-profile lawsuits, most recently involving YouTube and Meta platforms like Facebook and Instagram, do you think that this is going to spur more action in Washington to regulate either the content that's on apps that we talked about or how that content is delivered and how it does become addictive?
That's a really great question. Folks have called this like a bellwether case. In my conversations with people in like the legal profession, the route going towards content moderation has not been as fruitful because of protections of like, you know, free speech and so forth. So I do imagine that more will come down the line related to product liability and like these design features. But also I'm hoping that these will spur interest from other folks who are designing apps, putting children front and center, and how do we keep them safe? And can we create content that's positive or pro-social? You know, we know in our research, you know, looking at media effects, that there can be benefits, right? Depending on what the content is and who designs it. Is it designed to help children and to help them learn about things in the world? Why can't we take a similar approach when it comes to teens and so that they have safe and in enjoyable spaces online, just like we'd expect in real life? And so I feel like we'll see more coming down the line. And I hope that there will be more creative endeavors related to how do we flip this so that risk is not like something we think about later and it's the first thing in designing these products.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sarah Domoff is a professor of psychology at the University at Albany. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1851. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.